Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So glad to have you back here as we move forward into spring here. Well, spring has sprung quite some time ago. But let me just ask you people, maybe you can relate. Have you ever lost your wallet? Have you ever lost your wallet, and have you ever noticed the strange things you do when you look for your wallet? Because losing a wallet is a traumatic thing, because it means an impending visit to the DMV, and that alone makes it a very traumatic event, an event that motivates you to do things that are completely irrational in the hopes that you'll find the wallet. Anyway, we had such an incident here at the McBurney compound. Someone here in the Worldview crew lost her wallet. Now, her name will remain anonymous because we don't want to attach blame. We don't want to make fun of anyone, but the wallet was lost. And one of the things I noticed is that when you're looking for a wallet and hoping that you can find it so you don't have to go to the DMV, that you will go and look at things in bags and in places that you have not looked in at least 2 years. You'll open doors and you'll open boxes that you haven't opened in a year and a half in hopes that you'll find a wallet that you just lost less than 12 hours ago. And you'll keep doing that over and over. In fact, you'll search the same place at least 5 times in the hopes that the wallet will appear. Open the glove box. Look, it's not there. 2.5 hours later, you open the same glove box.
But I haven't prayed for it.
Maybe I missed it. Oh, that's it. We haven't prayed for a miracle.
No.
Now, why is it that when people have some undefined, murky illness, like a back problem, they'll pray for a miracle there, but when they lost their wallet, well, maybe some people do pray for miracles when they lost their wallet.
Maybe.
Well, that's something we haven't done. We haven't asked for a miracle, but we haven't found the wallet either.
Maybe that's what we need to do.
That's it. We obviously need to invoke supernatural forces in order to find the wallet. Anyway, I'm just checking the pocket in my jacket right now. And it has not materialized there, no matter how many times I check it. Anyway, so it's been quite a chaotic scene around the McBurney compound for the last 24 hours. But we're glad to have you on board, ladies and gentlemen. We'll get to all the news in just a moment. But I want to start with something. This isn't really news. This is just I don't even know what to call this, a sign of how ridiculous things are becoming here in America. I've got a story here from the Washington Times. The Washington Times reports that increasingly more home builders in the Washington area specifically are ditching the term master bedroom for the more politically correct term owner's bedroom. Okay, first of all, okay, note to the Washington Times. When you're reporting news on current events and societal developments, don't use the term ditching. It's simply beneath anyone who's reporting the news. That's a term you used in seventh grade when you left school after lunch without telling anyone. Home builders are ditching. You could say home builders are no longer using. Home builders are choosing not to use this term. But ditching is, it's an adolescent term beneath the reportage of news. And I think that's just another sign of the deterioration of the intellect and the communication abilities of just about everyone in the media.
Check this out.
It's going down. You hear them on CNN, they've got the gel in their hair, they're trying to act like they're 15, just got a new tattoo, tell you what's going down. Get out of here with that. And so I'm annoyed with them using the term ditching, okay? But The fact that the term master bedroom has fallen into disrepair is even more shocking to me. Let's get to that now that I can get past my bugaboo about them using adolescent terms, reporting the news. Apparently, master bedroom, they say it could have either dominant male or slave owner connotations. Now, would you ever thunk of that?
Thunk?
Well, there you go. Well, let's edit that out then, because I don't want to sound like a punk.
Yeah, bad.
Now, would you ever thought of that? That the term master bedroom is either a dominant male or slave owner? Did that ever enter your mind, my dear? Let me ask you. I'm going to ask my extremely attractive audio engineer. When you heard the term master bedroom, ever, once in your mind, did you ever think that of slave? That never entered my mind ever. Especially when I watched the black couple in Baltimore looking for a house on House Hunters. And they say, wow, what a beautiful master suite. I don't think they were thinking they were slave owner. I always thought master meant you're the master of the house. You know, like, anyway, it's just bizarre. See what happens when a civilization becomes fat and comfortable and loses their mooring with God and truth and reality? They start getting caught up in foolish, idiotic things, like worrying about if the term master bedroom might make someone worry that you secretly want to own black people. It's just outrageous. Anyway, they're in the home building industry in the Washington, D.C. area. One builder says that a few lawsuits have actually been brought against builders over the phrase.
Oh, come on.
So it's the lawyers again.
How many master bedrooms?
Yeah, I'm sure the lawyers have master bedroom with a master five-piece suite. All of them. Anyway, it's just outrageous. There are much more important things, ladies and gentlemen, for us to be concerned about in our interpersonal relationships with our fellow men. Rather than whether or not we offend someone with the use of the term master bedroom. We have a fine master bedroom here. And we don't have any slaves. We got nobody toiling in the fields here at the McBurney compound. That's right. We have a master suite that is, generally it's a children's playground. Yeah, it's a gymnasium and playground. All right, now let's move on from the ridiculous to the truly terrifying, ladies and gentlemen. There is a new outbreak in West Hollywood of a virulent strain of meningitis. Yeah. Now, this is a story from the New York Daily News. A 33-year-old West Hollywood man was sickened by bacterial meningitis earlier this week, and he's been declared brain dead amid warnings to sexually active gay men about the deadly strain of the illness. Yeah, it's gotten so bad that the councilman there, the West Hollywood City Councilman, his name is John Duran, he's issued a warning because, well, let's see what happened here. This 33-year-old homosexual was described last week as, openly gay and robust and healthy. Well, Monday, he began to feel sick. On Wednesday, he went to the emergency room. By Thursday, he was in a coma. Friday, they declared him brain dead.
Wow.
Yeah. So West Hollywood student councilman John Duran says, we're going to issue a warning, but we don't want to panic anyone. No, we've got a brain disease that'll kill you in a week. Yeah, because you're such a deviant in the back of a gay bar or a bathhouse because of what you people do to one another. But we don't want to panic anyone. We just want you to know that this brain disease is out there. It's in the bathhouses. It's in the bathrooms. But don't be scared. We don't want to alarm anyone. We certainly wouldn't want to restrict anyone's freedom to do what you people do in the just want to let you know that this brain disease kill you in a week. All right, don't be alarmed. Don't adjust your behavior. Anyway, I find it a bit ironic. Okay, let me just say this: that here in America, we're concerned about the term master bedroom, But we won't call sodomy what it is, a dangerous, filthy, disgusting, deadly practice. But we're worried that when we say master bedroom, well, we might offend. So you'll strain out a gnat and swallow a camel whole. All right, so for all you homosexual freaks in West Hollywood, you should be very concerned. Number one, meningitis could eat your brain and kill you in a week. And number two, you're living a lifestyle that is destroying yourself, body and soul and spirit. And you need to repent of your filthy, disgusting behavior and stop endorsing it for the children. And you need to turn to God. Because only He can help you when meningitis is eating your brain and killing you in a week. All right. Now, my dear, I'm going to go ahead and get all the homosexuals out of the way right here at the beginning of the show. And you won't have to worry about them anymore. There will be no more mention. Sure. Dateline Honolulu, Hawaii, from Fox News. A judge has ruled that a Hawaii bed and breakfast violated the law when two dykes were denied a room because they're, well, dykes. That's right. These two dykes are from Southern California, as you can well imagine. They went to a bed and breakfast there in Hawaii back in 2007. They tried to book a room. But the owner said, hey, we're Christians. We don't let perverts get rooms, and we don't let unmarried couples get rooms. Well, I'm sure that the bed and breakfast owner wasn't that detailed about it. She probably just said, you know, the owner said she was uncomfortable having lesbians in her house because of her religious views. Well, the lawyers and judges would not tolerate that. So the judge said the bed and breakfast violated the state's public accommodation laws, and is ordered, the judge is ordering this Christian woman to stop discriminating against same-sex couples. The public accommodations law there in Hawaii prohibits establishments that provide lodging to transient guests from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation, race, color, ancestry, religion, disability, and sex, including gender identity or expression. So did you notice this, how this law is written, ladies and gentlemen? Just to let you know how bad things have gotten and how far down the rim of hell we have slid. The law starts out with you cannot discriminate on the basis of, and the first thing, well, you'd think it would be race, right? Color, ancestry, you'd think, but no, the first thing is sexual orientation. Then race, color, ancestry, religion, disability, and then bookend that with gender identity or expression. So what has become the first and the last in the eyes of the public, and especially the governing class, the ruling elite? The first and the last has become sexual deviancy and perversion. It's the first thing they mention. It's the last thing they mention. It's the only thing on their mind, for crying out loud, in my opinion, amongst the perverts are writing the laws. The perverts have taken over the government. The deviants, the people who will drag you and your family straight to hell, are now ruling the country. As exemplified by this judge's ruling. And as exemplified by the way the law is written. The public accommodations law. They're in the state of Hawaii. Disgusting. Do we have anything else? Who's this? The executive director of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, which that's a group that promotes homosexuality. When you hear the word civil rights these days, that means the right for two men to sodomize one another in public. Oh, yeah, in public. That's right. That's what civil rights have become. Anyway, this commissioner, the executive director, William Hoshijo, he said, quote, when visitors or residents are subject to discrimination, they suffer the sting of indignity, humiliation, and outrage. But we are all demeaned and our society is diminished by unlawful discrimination, unquote. That is the executive director of Sodomy International, Sodomy Incorporated there in Hawaii. Anyway, I say that the perverts who are hurting themselves and others by their deviant sexual perverted behavior, they should be subjected to the sting of indignity, humiliation, and outrage. Okay? Maybe that will help them realize their devious and perverted ways and change their ways. If we would all put a stigma back on the fact that, well, they're doing things that simply can't even be mentioned in public, for crying out loud. All right, so the courts rule in favor of the deviant, pervert, sodomites, and against the Christians out in Hawaii. That's your judiciary. Now, that's also your legislative. They're the ones who wrote into the law that you can't discriminate against anyone who's a pervert. Meanwhile, in Buffalo, New York, where I was born, but I left as soon as possible, pro-life students at the University of Buffalo came under a fierce attack by a group of professors who compared the pro-life students to a lynch mob. And at least one professor was arrested after she launched a profanity-laced tirade against the pro-life display put on by the students. The professors at the university were outraged after the Students for Life Club received permission to display a pro-life exhibit that included graphic images of abortion victims, along with Holocaust victims and pictures of lynching victims. Had all these images up there together. And what will flip out a post-abortive college professor faster than seeing the image of an aborted, butchered child? Well, there's nothing that will flip them out faster. And this one particular professor, she absolutely went ballistic. She had to be restrained, handcuffed, and removed from the scene. And I've seen this before. If any of you have ever been out there speaking for the victims of abortion, speaking for the voiceless, and you show the pictures of what abortion really is, every once in a while you come across a post-abortive woman, and she'll go absolutely ballistic and lose control of herself. And if she wasn't restrained, she would probably gnash on you with her teeth and claw at your eyes with her hands. Because the guilt and the pain is so huge inside of her that it's going to explode and come out. She has no desire to repent and deal with the pain and the sin and seek forgiveness. She just keeps all that hatred and anger over the fact that she killed her own child. And then it comes out in situations like this. And that's exactly what I'm sure, what happened here at the University of Buffalo. So one post-abortive professor flips out. But about a half dozen other professors condemn the display in an open letter published in the student newspaper. So the professors organized against these pro-life students. Now, the professors did say that they do not object to the protest. They only object to the content of the protest. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I know this is the University of Buffalo, okay? It's not like the most prestigious institution in the country. But for a professor to say that I do not object to your protest, only to the content of your protest, it's simply outrageous. Mr. Professor, you have taught us that it's the content of our protest that is the protest. And when the homosexuals go out and parade themselves through the campus there at the University of Buffalo, do you think the instructors there, the professors, have issues with the content of that protest? No, that's a sacred display of freedom of speech. Mr. Professor, the content is the protest. You hypocrite. You idiot. All right. Christian Anzel, who's the president of the University Students for Life group, called the professor's attacks shameful. She says she was appalled that her professors twisted her message. She said she was offended. She says she knew that coming here and doing the display would be rough. And she says she's so proud of the pro-life students who stood up for the voiceless. Well, I suppose I have to give credit there. At least you're willing to go into the lion's den, speak up. But to actually, and I've done it too. I've gone to college campuses. some of the most terrifying moments of my life, going into a college campus and showing them what abortion is. You worry that they're going to kill you right there. Anyway, I'm not averse to trying to reach the poor, ignorant, lost, filthy, unwashed heathens in the universities. I simply would never advocate anyone actually send your child to attend there. All right, ladies and gentlemen, with that, we're going to get right into the domestic tranquility file. And it's, well, obviously we had the bombings in Boston. We all know what's happening there. Or I guess we all know what's happening there. I went online this morning. And, only the Drudge Report is saying that it's obvious that these terrorists are working with a larger network. Everyone else is kind of being coy, and they're not, well, we're not sure what their motivation is. You know, maybe they had been jilted by their girlfriend. Maybe they had been house hunting, and someone had used the term master bedroom. And being minorities, they felt offended and threatened, and so they bombed. We just don't know why. But meanwhile, the Islamic terrorists are a threat. But they're nothing compared to what the humanists are doing every day in our communities. The government education system, the justice system, the popular culture, they're producing a generation of soulless hellions with no conscience. And it's shocking to read about it every day. In fact, if you read as much news as I do every day, you'd consider taking a rocket to Mars. I think we have that in here somewhere. You'd want to leave the planet. Sometimes I just want to leave the planet. And here's why. This is from NBC in Chicago. Prosecutors say Rodrigo Rodriguez of Chicago confessed to repeatedly covering his daughter's mouth. He confessed to repeatedly covering his daughter's mouth last week. His girlfriend admitted to watching her boyfriend smother the five-month-old baby until her body went limp. Prosecutors say the couple had been drinking in the room where the girl was sleeping when the baby woke up and started crying. Their solution? Smother and kill the child. Anyway, they weren't able to kill the child. The child survived. They've been charged with aggravated battery. Okay, they should be publicly executed. That's all. From Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, a 69-year-old food vendor was loading his cart with food and supplies in Philadelphia when he was approached by a man who stabbed him in the neck. The victim was rushed to the hospital where he was later pronounced dead. The suspect ran away from the scene in what is believed to have been a robbery attempt. Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. From Onondaga County, New York, Syracuse. The Onondaga County District Attorney has said that 29-year-old David Rents, I can't read the story. I can't read it. This guy kidnapped a mother and daughter. He raped the daughter in front of the mother. Then he killed the mother and the daughters. I can't read it. I can't read what this guy did, okay? His name is David Renz, R-E-N-Z, David Renz, 29 years old. He had been wearing a GPS tracking device because He had just been released from jail after his arrest in January on federal child pornography charges. He was allowed to be... He was released, and he has now killed one woman. And anyway, I can't really read that. I have to... Well, it doesn't get any better in the domestic tranquility file, folks. It's quite depressing. From Quakertown, Pennsylvania, four family members appear to have died of carbon monoxide fumes because of the suicide attempt of the father of the family. The father went to the garage and started his car following a disagreement with his wife. They had had a fight. It is believed that the wife and the family's two daughters tried to rescue him from his suicide attempt, and they themselves were overcome by the fumes. And the entire family is dead now. The entire family is now. So when did, I don't know, when did suicide become an option? Who decided that we could? You know what? My extremely attractive audio engineer and I were talking the other night about the movie A Clockwork Orange, which she was shocked that I told her I watched that movie probably when I was 15 years old, and I remember sitting there. This is Clockwork Orange came out late 60s, early 70s, something like that. And I remember watching it secretly at my friend's house. Well, his parents didn't care what he watched on TV. We could stay up all night, watch HBO. So we watched A Clockwork Orange, and I remember sitting there in front of the TV. Now, I was not, I had been raised in a Christian household, but I was not a Christian. I was looking for any way to rebel and do bad. But I remember sitting there watching that movie saying, I can't believe that this is legal to put this like on TV. I can't believe that you could be allowed to make a movie like this and then show it in public. I couldn't believe it. Even as a rebellious little heathen, I recognize that was dangerous. So I don't know. I guess I trace it all back to the 60s. Why? Because, well, that's when I was born. So that's obviously when everything important started happening. So I'll choose that. I'll say, well, it all started in the 60s, but I probably go back to around 60 AD if you want to trace back the problem, or 60 BC or 600 BC. The problem has always been there. It just seems to be bubbling up with a particular virulence these days. That's pretty scary. Okay, let's go to a story that's not nearly as depressing or terrifying. You people have heard me mention the fact in a number of stories. You've heard me make allusions to the idea that, hey, the reason things are going wrong is because people are getting drunk, getting high, and having sex. Never discount the role that plays in disasters, tragedies, and perhaps the financial crisis. I've got a story here from CNBC. David Nutt, a British professor of something called neuropsychopharmacology, he says that it was cocaine that caused the financial meltdown. He has a theory. Now, he's a controversial fellow, as you can imagine, because... he's probably exposing something that the financial industry would rather not any of us know about. He says, the author of the CNBC article talks about Professor Nutt's theory that, you got a lot of bankers and investors and brokers hopped up on cocaine, and, you know, what do you expect is going to happen? It's going to go, 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 great, 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 and then boom, crash. I mean, it's just like cocaine, right? So the CNBC author says, well, I thought, when I first read this story, I assumed it was a hoax. The professor's name is Nutt, and he's got this nonsensical-sounding occupation, neuropsychopharmacologist. He says, come on. But, he says, Nutt's a real person, and neuropsychopharmacology is actually a real thing. And he says, there is. Now, this is a CNBC insider. This guy reports on the investment community, and the reporter says there is a lot of cocaine use in finance. But, he says, Dr. Nutt, if you're searching for pharmacological contributors to the crisis, this is the meltdown, 2007 through 2009, you all remember that? He says if you're looking for pharmacological contributions to the crisis, you shouldn't stop at cocaine. Far more prevalent than cocaine are Ritalin and Adderall. Yeah. So these are the attention deficit disorder pills that people are popping. It's basically low-dose methamphetamine, which is like every broker's dream. You know, the ability. Anyway, the author says, no doubt a lot of the billion little decisions that contributed to the financial crisis were made under the influence of drugs. See? Guarantee it. I remember by the time I was 15, my mother thought everyone was on drugs. And it turns out she was pretty much right. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. I want to thank you for joining us as we delve deep into the psyche of America. I actually got in trouble with a professional associate because I was talking about Adderall in conversation, and I said, isn't that just speed? and the young lady who was in the meeting was on it. And she became a bit offended. She said, well, it is unless you need it. She said, it is speed unless you need it. And then it's something different. And so I tried to be nice. I was like, hey, I'm just saying, isn't it amphetamines? That's, you know, just because you're popping them, whatever, you know. I hope you're fine. I didn't mean to offend you, but, you know. All I'm saying is I just wanted to inquire about the chemical compound in Adderall. Now, she did say that Ritalin is very bad. But Adderall, if you need it, it's good. Anyway, speaking of people on drugs, ladies and gentlemen, Anthony Weiner is in second place in a poll for the Democrat race for the mayor of New York. He's yes. Again, proving my mother's old axiom, everyone is on drugs. Yeah. 50% of Democrats said they wouldn't consider voting for Anthony Weiner. Ladies and gentlemen, that means 50% of Democrats would vote for Anthony Weiner. He's currently in second place there. He's going to run for mayor. Anyway, we're just going to leave all the potential wisecracks aside. We'll leave that up to Drudge's headline writers. They've been having a ball with this all week. It's just, yeah. We'll leave all that to them. Thank you very much. All right. I actually have a lighthearted story from the Domestic Tranquility File, but it ends in a very serious fashion. So pay attention. This is Newark, New Jersey. Anthony Reynolds. He's, a young man there, 18-year-old in Newark, has received a 55-month prison sentence. He pled guilty last September to motor vehicle theft. Turns out 18-year-old Reynolds and an accomplice were traveling in a stolen BMW when they came upon a Porsche 911 Turbo in the Newark area. So young Mr. Reynolds, armed with a .38 caliber revolver, approached the driver of the Porsche and ordered him out of the car. Meanwhile, his accomplice sped off in the BMW, leaving Reynolds with the Porsche, which he intended to steal. But the Porsche was a stick shift, and this stupid punk got into the Porsche, and he couldn't figure out how to make it go. The Porsche's owner flagged down police, and Mr. Reynolds was arrested because he couldn't drive a stick. I know, it's funny, right? It's a lighthearted story. Yeah. But let me just end on a serious note, ladies and gentlemen. 18-year-old Anthony Reynolds, he stuck a .38 caliber revolver in the face of this guy driving the Porsche. And I know what many of you are saying. Most people driving a Porsche deserve to have a .38 caliber revolver stuck in their face. But that's not the case. It's, well, the old, there's an old joke about what's the difference between a porcupine and a Porsche driver. I can't tell the punchline because it's vulgar. But many of you out there will understand. Anyway, if you stick a .38 caliber revolver in anyone's face, even though you couldn't drive the stick and we're all chuckling at the story, Mr. Reynolds, I would sentence you to death for sticking a .38 caliber revolver, even though the guy was driving a Porsche, okay? That's a death penalty offense. Anytime you stick a gun in someone's face and you threaten them, that's attempted murder and you should be executed. So we could all chuckle at the fact that you can't drive a stick while we kill you. Publicly, painfully, this Porsche driver should have the option of killing you himself. In fact, he should be able to take his stick shift out of his Porsche and beat you to death with it in front of God and everybody. And then you wouldn't have 18-year-olds who have no business even driving. They wouldn't be carjacking anyone. I can assure you of that. That would end the spree of carjackings in the greater Newark area if this punk were beaten to death with a stick shift. All right. I know. My extremely attractive audio engineer, she's been lamenting the fact that she was driving one of the last stick shifts in America up until a few months ago when the car was, well, it was disabled in an unfortunate incident. And now my extremely attractive audio engineer is forced to drive an automatic transmission. And she hates it. She wants a stick. I'll get you a stick one of these days, baby. But I'll tell you what, in order to get a stick now, you got to buy like a Ferrari or something. You can't get a Camry with a stick. You can't get a Ford Taurus with a stick. It's, you're not going to get a Chevy Cavalier with a stick. You're not going to get a Dodge with a stick. Chrysler, no way. You're not going to get a minivan with a stick. Anyway, it's not going to happen. All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, let's go to the science. Really? File. An Iranian scientist claims to have invented a time machine. Yes, he says his device can predict details of the next 5 to 8 years. Huh? 5 to 8, he says. I'm not sure where why it's limited to that, but he's got a time machine. He says he's registered the invention with Iran's state-run Center for Strategic Inventions. He's also said he's concerned about the Chinese stealing his idea and producing it in the millions. Mohammed Medijinad Nouri, who is the Deputy Minister of Science, Research, and Technology at Iran's State Organization for Registration of Deeds and Properties. Whew. He says that they don't have any such registration on the books. So, I mean, when the mullahs in Iran are saying that you're crazy. Anyway, I don't know why I did this story. Oh, I know. Because I wanted to compare it to another story that I have. Let's see here if I can find it. There's where... Yeah. Well, it was either Stephen Hawking or the three planets that can sustain life. Should I go right to those? I suppose I should. Let me move these up here in the rotation. So you've got a guy in Iran, Persia, let's say, who says he's invented a time machine. Meanwhile, Stephen Hawking has drawn standing room only crowds at the California Institute of Technology. Last Tuesday, he put on a show there, a stage show. They were giving away free tickets. Stephen Hawking was giving a lecture entitled The Origin of the Universe. And there was a line that was about a quarter of a mile long of young, ignorant, unwashed, filthy, hedonistic, heathen students who wanted to go in and find out from Stephen Hawking, the high priest of atheism, how the universe started apart from God, who would ever judge them for what they did in their dorm room last night. Yeah, that's what they line up for there at the college. So let's see, the auditorium was jammed, packed, oversold, standing room only. They had to open a second auditorium with a Jumbotron TV with another 1,000 students in it. One person was observed on the sidewalk offering $1,000 for a ticket, and he could not get one. That's how desperate these college students were to get in to see the high priest, who will absolve them of all their sins of what they've experimented with in the dorms, in the bathrooms, at the bars, there in their university experience. Which, by the way, any of my kids, if they want to go to college, number one, I'll do my best to physically restrain them. Number two, I'll never pay a penny to send them to any one of these filthy, devious universities. I never went to college. And I turned out pretty screwed up, frankly. Had I gone to college, I probably wouldn't be alive. So anyway, and I recommend that you don't send your kids to university or college or anything like that. And I don't care. I don't care who it is or where it is. I don't recommend it. That's all. For all of you kids who are going to college, if you're offended, tough. All right. Stephen Hawking began the event there at the California Institute of Technology by reciting an African creation myth. That's his way of, you know, his way of dismissing the creation story. To say, well, it's a myth. You got it off the caves in Africa. You know, we've got stories on papyrus from way before this guy Moses, the whole thing. There's creation myths all over. So he opens up with a myth. And then after outlining the historical theological debate about how the universe was created, Hawking began to cover what's called steady state theory. The theory that there is no beginning and no end, and that galaxies continue to form from spontaneously created matter all the time, and it just keeps going. Well, Stephen Hawking has dismissed that theory. He says that steady state doesn't hold up, and there's other theories, and they don't hold up either. Then, as the young college students were on the edges of their seat, Hawking then discussed the idea of a repeating Big Bang. That's right. But then he went on to say how he had disproven that theory back in the 80s. Repeating Big Bang, that doesn't hold up either. And the students let out a collective breath, wondering, when will the high priest give us the keys and tell us from whence we came? Well, Hawking then said, as the students leaned forward, time began at the moment of singularity, and this has likely only occurred once. And the students were astonished. What is the high priest saying, that there was a creation? No, no, no. He closed by outlining what's called M theory. Stephen Hawking says M theory is the only theory, it's the only big idea that really explains what he has observed in the physical universe. M theory posits that multiple universes are created out of nothing, with many possible histories and many possible states of existence. In only a few of these states, said Hawking, would life be possible. And in fewer still, could something like humanity exist. And at the end, Hawking mentioned that he felt fortunate to be living in this particular state of existence. Even though he's suffering with a debilitating disease, he's quite thankful that out of the billions, perhaps trillions, of different universes in the multiverse that all occur out of nothing, that we've all been fortunate enough just to happen to have passed through this particular universe. At which point, all the students went outside and lit up joints and made their way to the gay bars and the bathhouses. And that's just my opinion about college, that if you send your kid to college or university, I really think that it's just not worth the risk, because they're going to be surrounded by deviants and perverts. And typically the deviants and the perverts pull the decent people down. Rarely do the decent people lift the perverts and the deviants up. So anyway, maybe it's because I have daughters and I'm not going to send them into anything like that. Maybe those of you with sons, you know, put on the breastplate of righteousness and, you know, get in there. But not for my girls. That's all. All right. Now, speaking of people who are all on drugs, had we already moved on from that? Oh, well, Stephen Hawking. Scientists announced last Thursday the discovery of three planets that are some of the best candidates so far to be habitable, to sustain life outside of our own solar system. That's right. This comes to us from the Science, really, file. These planets, two of the planets, Kepler-62e and Kepler-62f, are described in a study released this week in the journal Scientist. Scientists claim liquid water could theoretically exist on the surface of these two planets, along with another one, Kepler-62. They say it's quite possible, is what they're saying. And one of the scientists says that with all these discoveries we're finding, Earth is looking less and less like a special place, and more like there's Earth-like things everywhere. There's just Earths everywhere. You can't swing a dead cat in the universe without hitting a planet with liquid water that sustains life. It's just amazing. They're everywhere. Now, I've got this story from CNN, okay, and they have quite the science department over there. The science, really, department at CNN. They say that if scientists' notions of a habitable zone, that's what they're saying about these planets, hey, they're all within this habitable zone, man. There could be, like, you know, life. There might even be chicks. Let's go. Anyway, that's the habitable zone theory. Scientists note that if the notion of a habitable zone were applied to our own solar system, both Earth and Mars would fall into that habitable zone. And we all know that there's virtually no difference between Earth and Mars. We know that Mars is just bursting with, oh yeah, there's just red dirt, right? And dust, and freezing cold and hot, and there's no life, and there's no liquid water. Pretty much proving that this whole idea of a habitable zone is much ado about just a foggy, hazy idea. It's pretty much useless. So all these planets in the habitable zone, my prediction, nothing. Not a scrap, not a particle of water. Not a single-celled amoeba, nothing, forever, ever. I know, people say, well, you shouldn't be so unequivocal. You never know what we might find out. Well, I'm here to tell you, there ain't nothing else out there, folks. There ain't no habitable zone. Earth is a pretty special place, I'm here to tell you. And if they ever do find life on another planet, I'll volunteer to go there and eat it. I doubt I'd be allowed to do that. But I would volunteer to do that. That's how sure I am that there is no habitable zone and there is no life outside of this planet Earth. Now, speaking of that, this is from the BBC. A Dutch organization called Mars One is taking applications for a one-way trip to Mars. Remember we covered this? Mars One has already received thousands of prospective applicants. But turns out most of these applications are people suggesting other people who should go on their one-way trip to Mars. You know, is one guy suggests his boss, this other guy suggested his landlord, another woman suggested her ex-husband should be the one. Now, do you have anyone, my dear, my extremely attractive audio engineer, I'm going to put you on the spot here, not to put too much pressure on you, but do you have anyone that you would suggest?
Anthony Weiner,
number one. First of all would be Anthony Weiner. Second would be, you know who I would nominate for the one-way trip to Mars? Would be Hugh Hefner and his daughter. Only because he's going to die soon anyway, and we need to get her off this planet.
No.
Oh, yeah, she's evil.
Yeah, I know, but...
Yeah, they both need to go. In fact, let's just send her.
No, don't send them to Mars.
No? Well, I mean, they would be a roundabout way to get them to hell, you know. So that would be my nomination. And then Howard Stern would be up there. Bill Maher, definitely. And then who's that queer on the Comedy Channel now? That skinny little blonde queer guy. I would send him too. I can't think of his name. Almost every. Okay, in fact, the entire network. If we could do a Mars space station one way ticket. All right. So there you have it. Do I have anything else? The Martian surface. According to this story, the Martian surface is extremely hostile to life. There's no liquid water. The atmospheric pressure is practically a vacuum. And radiation levels are higher and temperatures vary wildly. That's why no one can live on Mars. And that's why this is a one-way ticket, brother, if you go, right? Radiation, increased cancer risk, lowers your immune system, possible infertility. Mars is quite hostile. But I just want to remind everyone that according to scientists who are looking for life, extraterrestrial life, Mars falls within their habitable zone. Just so you know, hey, maybe we should send these guys. All these guys who say it's in the habitable zone, let's send them to see just how habitable. Yeah, let's send Mario Antoinette. Have you seen the show, Ancient Aliens? Talk about pandering to a tiny demographic, my dear. There's probably only 10 or 12 people in the country who've ever seen Ancient Aliens all the way through. Now, my extremely attractive audio engineer and I, we watch Ancient Aliens for one reason and one reason only, and that's to keep track of the hair on that one guy who my wife dubbed Mario Antoinette. He's got this big poofy hairdo, and he talks about how everything came from aliens, and we're all, I don't know, descendants of aliens. There is no God, but there's aliens, basically, he says, with his big bouffant hairdo. Anyway. All right. Now we're running out of time. Quit yucking it up, my dear. Nobody else can even relate to this story. She's cracking up. She's got tears coming out of her eyes. And no one in the audience is like, Mario Antoinette, Ancient Aliens, is that a show on TV? Claire, I've never heard of that
one. Check it out. It's on the History Channel.
Check it out. It's on the History Channel. And Mario Antoinette and his theories about the beginnings of the universe and life and aliens.
By the way, his name is in that
book. They're worth, yeah, we don't know what his name is. But anyway, his theories are worth listening to just for sheer entertainment value. I mentioned earlier the line in the Bible about straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel whole. Well, Mario Antoinette is the personification of that verse. Anyway, fun stuff. Now, on to less fun stuff. Let's talk. Should we talk about the bombing in Boston? I want to go, before I go to the bombing in Boston, ladies and gentlemen, let's go to Iraq. For everyone who supports our efforts in Iraq, and the idea of democratization of the Muslim world, to all of you, On the day that the Boston Marathon was bombed and three people were killed and a couple hundred were wounded, in Iraq, they were getting ready for the first elections to take place since U.S. troops have withdrawn. The vote took place on April 20th, just a day or two ago. And in the weeks leading up to the election, a total of 14 election hopefuls had already been murdered. And just 12 of the 18 provinces there in Iraq are going to take place. There have been 30 bombings and shootings in 12 different areas of Iraq, leaving 55 people dead. That all happened, by the way. 30 bombings, 12 shootings, 55 people dead. That all happened on Monday, March 19th. That all happened on the day that the Chechen Islamic terrorists bombed the Boston Marathon. There were 30 bombs in Iraq. So I don't know, anyone who thought we were going to win that war and we were going to win the hearts and minds of our Muslim brethren, well, it's just not looking good. Iraqi officials believe that the insurgent group in Iraq is growing stronger and increasingly coordinating with allies fighting to topple Syrian President Bashar Assad across the border. So here's what's happened, ladies and gentlemen. By force of arms, we, the Americans, installed a Muslim-dominated government there in Iraq. Why? Well, because we're not Christians anymore. We felt no compulsion to, no obligation to wipe out this heathen religion and install Christians to run the place. We didn't feel that because we're no longer a Christian country. So what have we done? We've sentenced the entire Middle East to death by a thousand cuts or a thousand bombings. The violence will increase and convulse that region for a generation because the Christians lost their nerve. Because we no longer were willing to say that it is this religion, this evil, demonic, satanic religion that must be wiped off the face of the earth and replaced by the true religion of the living God, the creator God, who can actually save these people from what they're about to go through. If you think Boston was bad, I mean, go to Baghdad. Go to Iraq, where on that morning, 30 bombs went off. We should be ashamed of what we've done to these people. To have gone in there and expended so much blood and treasure to leave the place a worse wreck than when we found it, for crying out loud. We should be ashamed of ourselves. And I can tell you this, that we will, as a nation, we will pay for this sin. We will pay in blood for this sin. In fact, we've got a warning from Bashar al-Assad, that ferret-faced little weasel. He always looked like, to me, picture him in your mind if you can, ladies and gentlemen. Bashar Assad, Syrian president, he always looked to me like the guy who would bring it all down just to save his own skin. He would do anything to save himself. He would kill anyone. He would sell his own mother into slavery, this little weasel-faced rat. Well, here's what he said. I've got from NBC News. President Bashar Assad accused the West last week of supporting al-Qaeda militants in Syria. And he warned that they would turn against their backers. That's Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and who's that other? John Kerry, all of them. They've been sending what they call non-lethal aid to these. These are al-Qaeda terrorists. Well, Assad warns that these terrorists will turn against their backers, the Americans and the Europeans, and strike the heart of Europe and the United States. So this little weasel, Bashar Assad, he's absolutely right. And he knows about turning on his backers and being devious and biting the hand that feeds you and bombing the hand that feeds you. Assad would do anything. And the people that are about to topple Assad are actually worse than he is. And we're supporting them. All right, I'm running out of time. The FBI interviewed, this is embarrassing for everyone involved, the FBI interviewed the older Boston Marathon bombing suspect 2 years ago and failed to find any incriminating information about it. The interview was made after an investigation launched by the FBI at the request of a foreign government. That was Russia. So everyone was confused when Barry came out a couple days after the bombings and he thanked Vladimir Putin. And I remember reading in the, I'm like, what's he thanking Putin for? I hadn't put two and two together. But he was probably thanking Putin because Putin probably handed him a file on these two guys that's an inch thick. And all the terrorists that they're associated with back there in Chechnya and Dagestan. You know, Vlad's like, Barry, I tried to tell you 3 years ago. Barry, you should listen to Vlad. Anyway, so now we know why Barry was thanking Vlad, because now the Russians, 2 years ago, they tried to tell us. Now they've probably handed a file over to our people. And we've got the names of, who knows, countless Chechen terrorists who are here in the United States, over in Chechnya. Thank you, Vladimir. So that's got to be pretty embarrassing when the Russian government tells you, hey, check these guys out. They're suspicious. You know, and our bumbling FBI, well, we can't find anything. You know, I know he's gone to this jihadist website. He did click like on all this, but gee, you know, he hasn't. We really don't have a crime here. So I think, ladies and gentlemen, in the current atmosphere, that if you go on a jihadist website and you retweet something or you repost something or you click like on someone who's saying death to America, you should at the very least be arrested immediately and quite possibly deported or executed. I don't know. Can you execute someone for clicking like on Facebook? I guess there would have to be a pattern of likes and retweets and posting of radical videos. To me, that's enough right there. I'm picking you up, and I might drop you out of a helicopter in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I don't know what's going to happen to you, but I'm certainly not going to stand around and wait for you to blow the legs off of children. Anyway, this bastard, this older brother, he traveled to Russia last year, and he spent 6 months out there. And of course, the immediate news report said, well, he did travel to Russia, but we don't know that there was anything there. How can you report the news that way? The guy's a Chechen. He traveled to Russia 6 months before he blew up. Wouldn't the safe thing to do would be to assume that there's something there? He went back to Russia for something, maybe to meet with the Chechen terrorist. I can't believe the way people report it. Well, we always want to see the bright and sunny side of everything. We think he might have went to Russia just to help poor starving children. Yeah, he opened a food bank, we think. No, it turns out he was training with Chechen terrorists and learning how to build bombs. And that'll all come out. Meanwhile, the Chechen president, he says... What did he say? He said it would be appropriate if, before the terrorists were killed, the Chechen president said they should be detained and investigated. The circumstances of their guilt should be determined. He says, hey, these two were raised in the United States and their attitudes and beliefs were formed in the United States. It is necessary to seek the roots of this evil in America. Not Chechnya, says the Chechen president. And I somewhat agree with him that we need to seek the roots of this evil in America. You know what's evil is that our government allows people like this to sit here and fester without finding them and stopping them from their devious deeds. And this goes back to my other theory. There's really only one way to stop someone who's not afraid to die. So these terrorists, they're going on suicide missions. How do you deter someone who's not afraid to die? Or who wants to die? Who wants to go meet Allah and get whatever? How do you deter someone like that? Well, folks, it's a very, very ugly, ugly thing that you have to do. But it needs to be done. And I think that if you publicize the fact that the next terrorist, the next bomb that goes off, the next shooting that occurs that we relate to Islamic terrorism, well, we're going to wipe out that person's whole family and the whole town. And that's it. And if you do it, then it's on you. It's not on us because we warned you. If you blow up our civilians, we are going to annihilate the city of your birth. And everyone around you that you loved and cared for, they're all going to die because of what you did. And see, you only have to do that for a very short period of time, and this kind of thing would stop. You have to strike so much fear into the heart of these people that they won't do it. And that's the only way, I'm afraid, to... And I know it's ugly, it's terrible to even think about it, that you would do something like that. But I think that's appropriate, okay? And I welcome your comments, although you probably won't change my mind. Okay, now, the Boy Scouts of America has called an end to their long-standing ban on queers. Yep, they say they're going to do it. They're going to let the queers into the tents and to go along on the scouting trips. But the organization's board, they say, must still vote in May. So this is yet another trial balloon sent up by the Boy Scouts of America. They say we're going to lift the ban on gay scouts, but we're not going to allow gay scout leaders. So they're going to cut the baby in half, so to speak. Yeah, the organization's spokesman says they're going to insert language that no youth may be denied membership in the Boy Scouts of America on the basis of sexual orientation or preference alone. The organization's spokesman said that the decision is drawn from 3 months of arduous research, surveys, and discussions, and they say it was among the most complex and challenging issues facing the Boy Scouts and society. It's challenging. So difficult to struggle with these issues of whether we should have boys sodomizing one another in the tents. It's such a complicated, sophisticated, difficult issue. Listen to this, folks. Patrick Boyle, who's a deviant who wrote a book in 1994 called Scouts Honor that examined sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts, which is rampant, by the way. Here's what he says. He says, quote, "You have more than a 100-year-old organization changing what it considered a fundamental belief less than 10 years ago. He says that says a lot about the Boy Scouts, and it says even more about how far the gay rights movement has come in the United States. And boy, is that not a terrifying and prophetic statement. In less than 10 years, the Boy Scouts, one of the oldest organizations in the country, has gone from, they won a Supreme Court case, supremely confident in the righteousness of their policy to keep out the queers. In less than a decade, they've capitulated. And it is a harbinger. It's a warning of things to come, ladies and gentlemen. And I say, regarding all these groups, the Boy Scouts, the Republicans, don't donate your money to any of these. Focus on your own family. It's the only place where you have a snowball's chance in hell of affecting an organization for the better anymore. They're all on their way to hell. That's it, folks. I want to thank my friends at KGOV, Denver Bible Church, American Right to Life, and, of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen. Here at the Weekly Worldview Studio, should the Lord tarry, I'll be back with you next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.